Welcome to series two of 251, Two Pianists, Five Podcasts, One Subject. And the subject of this series is the piano player Kenny Drew. My name's Nick Tomlin.
And I'm Simon Whiteside. And as Nick has just said, we'll be talking about Kenny Drew in this series, but unlike our first series on Sonny Clark, which was broadly biographical, we've chosen to pick five albums that we both like and think represent his career. His career was quite varied. He was born in New York. He had some time on the West Coast. Then he came back to New York for a bit and then moved off to, first of all, Paris in Europe. And then eventually he made his home in Copenhagen, where he was a house pianist for many years and made quite a lot of live recordings. In fact, most of his playing career was actually out of America. But the albums we're going to talk about are, in fact, the ones that led up to him leaving for Europe. And Nick, I think you've got a bit more detail on his life.
Yes, Kenny was born in New York City on the 28th of August, 1928. And a bit like Sonny Clark, he was really a prodigy. He started learning the piano very early, age 4 or 5, and quickly progressed to giving his first recital when he was only 8 years old. And a bit later, he attended the High School of Music and Art, which I think was in Harlem in New York City.
Yeah, it started out in Harlem. It was informally known as M&A, or Music and Art. And it was a public specialised school, so it's quite unusual. And it was the brainchild of LaGuardia, the mayor, who obviously has the airport named after him in New York as well. But eventually, there was another school and which did similar sort of stuff, and they merged together. So it's now actually called the LaGuardia High School of Music and Arts, and it's at a different location now. But it was colloquially known as the Castle on the Hill because the building was on Hamilton Heights up in Harlem. So a lot of very well-known people in the arts, particularly in Manhattan and New York City, went to that college. I think you've got a few other jazz musicians that went there.
Yeah, well, some of the other jazz musicians were Billy Cobham, probably a bit later, Kenny Washington, and Gil Coggins, and also the film composer Michael Kamen went there. So there was it really produced some notable alumni.
Yeah, and there's people from all different, so there are film producers, there are drummers, like, you know, drummers, musicians, hip-hop musicians, all sorts of different people, actors, and it was quite, and probably still is, particularly, I mean, it's sort of Fame, isn't it, the Fame Academy type place, even though that mm-hmm. that's a different school.
Mm-hmm.
So where else, what was Kenny's early career like?
Well, one of the first jobs he had was as an accompanist for the Pearl Primus dance company. And Pearl Primus was an Afro-American choreographer, and I think she was quite innovative. She was really into bringing black culture and African culture into dance. And she had a dance school in Harlem, and Kenny was obviously played for the dance classes, I guess, initially. But at the same time, he was also playing with some local musicians. There was a little scene around Harlem at that time. Sonny Rollins was there, Jackie McLean, Art Taylor. And he sort of alternated on piano with Walter Bishop Jr. in this little local band where they, I guess it was more just kind of playing together and hanging out.
Yeah, some local band, eh?
not a bad band, yeah.
I think when he was big, younger, he was more influenced by like Teddy Wilson and I think he also played a lot of boogie woogie on his own for things around Harlem. And his earliest recordings are in New York, aren't they? I think.
Yeah. So his first recording was with the trumpet player Howard McGee in 1950, and that really began I suppose, the beginning of his professional career. And over the next few years, I mean, he recorded with people like Sonny Stitt, and he recorded with Lester Young as well, Sonny Rollins, Buddy DeFranco. He became a kind of in-demand kind of player from that period, really.
It's quite interesting how his career overlaps quite a bit with Sonny Clark, who was the subject of our previous podcast, which, by the way, is all available on your usual podcast provider if this is the first time you're listening to us. And, you know, people like Dinah Washington and Buddy DeFranco, they kind of handed each other the job, didn't they? Or the job went between the two of them.
Yeah, yeah. Like you say, there is quite a lot of overlap between. It's quite interesting how much there is in common between the two in a way.
I suppose they're relatively similar age, aren't they? So that's another aspect, which means that they're probably similar. I don't know about you, but I find that you tend to have groups of musicians of the similar age in big cities who are playing together because they went to college together or they know each other from socially. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that's also part of the deal. Well, we're going to treat this, as I said, this series is going to be slightly different. We're going to talk about an album at a time because he did have such a long career that it will be, more than five podcasts to cover that. So the first album we're going to talk about is actually often grouped with that Howard McGee album, and it's called it was a series, I think, called New Faces, New Sounds that Blue Note were doing on 10 inch 33 and a third RPM records, and Introducing the Kenny Drew Trio is the name of that album. So after this short break, we will start talking about that.
The first album that Kenny recorded under his own name was part of the New Faces, New Sounds Blue Note series, and the album was called Introducing the Kenny Drew Trio. It was recorded on April the 16th, 1953, in the Van Gelder Studio in Hackensack, the original Van Gelder Studio in New Jersey. If you'd like to listen to this album, the best thing really is to visit our Facebook page, where we'll put up the playlists for all of the music that we're going to be talking about. Unfortunately, we can't play the actual tracks because for copyright reasons, but we've also set up a Patreon page where you can sponsor these podcasts, which mean that we can hopefully in the future pay to include the actual tracks. But until then, the best way is to listen to the playlist, or there will also be some links we'll put in the show notes as well. So anyway, going on to talk about this recording, the personnel for this recording were obviously Kenny Drew on piano, Art Blakey on drums, and Curly Russell on bass.
Yes, and as you said, it was recorded at the Hackensack Studio. The album that he'd played on with Howard McGee was when they were still using the WOR studios, and it was quite near to the beginning of the Hackensack studio, which Rudy Van Gelder has set up as part of his parents' house. And a lot of good albums were recorded there. They moved over to the bigger and purpose-built studio. I think it was 1959, wasn't it, Nick, from my memory from previous previous podcasts. Mm-hmm. The first track was released as well as on this album, was released as 78 single, I think. And I was talking to Rich Capeless from the Deep Groove Mono website, who well worth checking out, Deep Groove Mono, for vintage jazz recording, particularly of the Blue Note and Riverside, those sorts of albums. And yesterday's, I suppose you'd call it, in many ways, it's got similarities to that track we talked about, Willow Weep For Me, that Sonny Clark recorded in that Macambo Club trio, where he does quite a lot of solo playing in it, as well as using the trio, doesn't he?
Yeah, and you can, again, really hear the Art Tatum influence. A lot of these bebop players, these kind of early bebop players, were really influenced by Art Tatum. He was kind of a hero for a lot of them. And you can really hear, particularly in the intro, he does this really kind of virtuosic, kind of Tatum-esque intro, really kind of showing off his technique.
I mean, I found it interesting. I would say I agree with you on that, but I would say that he's much more modern in his approach than Sonny Clark was. on that version of Willow Weep for Me. And also, he does tend to avoid that sort of major sixth chord flurry that is very synonymous with swing players.
Mm-hmm.
Although the tune itself is a swing tune, really. It comes from 1933, and it's a Jerome Kern number. It was written for Roberta, which was a musical based on the novel Gowns, and was also made into a film later on. And the other great tune from that show and film, I think they're both in the film, was Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. But I think he's more Bud Powell, and he's particularly more Bud Powell when he gets into his trio solo, isn't he?
Yeah, you can really hear the Bud Powell influence. It's very obvious, especially the left hand is very Bud Powell. The way he tends to play these shell voicings, but also these kind of ostinato figures as well in the left hand, which Bud Powell used to do. And the language as well, the right hand language is really very indebted to Bud Powell. In fact, I mean, some of the actual phrases he's playing, you can actually trace back to Bud Powell, some of his recordings in the late 40s, which were hugely influential for a lot of these players.
I did listen to a version of Bud Powell playing yesterday's, and I was expecting it to be more similar, if I'm honest. There's a trio version, I think from 1944, might be, I'm guessing there. But it was quite different. But I mean, you can obviously hear that Kenny Drew has transcribed quite a lot of Bud Powell, listened to a lot. And I think the other thing you really notice is that he's got really good technique, really good classical musical technique, really, I suppose. It's a very, very crisp semi-quaver action when he, and often does, choose to play fast passages. And this is also a very fast speed, isn't it?
Yeah. No, he. It's really noticeable, especially, our last series was about Sonny Clarke. And sort of comparing the two, I think you would say that, Kenny Drew has the sort of superior technique, just purely in terms of piano technique. I think you can really hear the difference, even on this early recording of Kenny Drew.
I think that's all I've really got to say on this track. Have you got any more to add?
No, I don't think so.
Well, then we'll move on to the second track, which is Stella by Starlight. So I've transcribed this. It will be available on our Patreon page if you're a Patreon subscriber, and as a PDF. Stella by Starlight is an interesting tune, very much a very popular standard now. But at the time he recorded it, not so much. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think Charlie Parker probably did the first jazz recording of Stella by Starlight in 1949, when he recorded an album with a string ensemble, Charlie Parker with strings, and I think it was really that version which then inspired a lot of other musicians to start playing it. But around this time, it wasn't the kind of the war horse that it has become, Stella by Starlight. It was still, I think, relatively unknown as a standard.
Well, it's a Victor Young tune. And it was material composed for the main title of a soundtrack, and it appeared within the score as well, a 1944 Paramount film called The Uninvited, in the sort of film noir period, really. And it does appear in the body of the film as well as an instrumental theme song without lyrics. It was Ned Washington who added the lyrics in 1946. And the title, it had to be incorporated into the lyrics, really, because the film has a scene where Rick, played by Ray Milland, tells Stella, played by Gail Russell, that he is playing a serenade to Stella by Starlight. So that's how it got its title. And, of course, the weird thing is that normally in a song like that, You Must Believe in Spring, for example, a song like that will have You Must Believe in Spring very, very clearly placed at key points, whereas the Stella by Starlight bit isn't really, it's not the first or last line. It's not like a hook, I suppose.
No.
It's more like slipped in there. And of course, Miles Davis made it very well known, didn't he, in his 50s recordings?
Yeah, I think his version became the version that people tend to play in terms of the harmony. And what's interesting listening to this Kenny Drew version is that he really uses the original changes, which if you look at the sheet music for this, the chord changes are kind of different to how jazz musicians tend to play it nowadays, and it's quite interesting to see that.
Yeah, and also the key. I mean, Stan Getz plays it in a different key to most people, I noticed, but generally people play it in B flat, don't they? Whereas he's playing it in G here, and the first chord, I'm not sure if this is going to work because my MIDI piano is plugged in at the same time, but let's see. He plays a diminished chord on G on the first, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Which lasts for two bars, whereas normally it's a 2-5, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons jazz musicians like it so much is because it does have some interesting changes and some interesting 2-5 relationships, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of modulates quite a lot, doesn't it? It moves around. It's interesting, the piano player Barry Harris talks about this quite a lot. There's a couple of YouTube videos where he's talking about this song, and he mentions that he says that everybody plays it wrong. he said that the first chord should really be a diminished chord, but I suppose, you know, it's the thing about jazz is you can kind of interpret things how you want to, but he makes a point of saying that first chord should really be a diminished chord.
And one of the things we've vowed to do in this series is for non-musicians, we get a lot of jazz musician friends and other people who like jazz listening who know a lot about the music, but we should explain a few little things more this series, I think. So a diminished chord sounds like this. It's often used as a sort of scary chord in silent movies, etc. And it's a really useful chord in many ways. It's sometimes was described to me by a composition teacher as the Clapham Junction of chords, because you can go anywhere from there.
And it's also got a very kind of tense sound, hasn't it? Which I think in this particular tune it's used to kind of create sort of tension, doesn't it? Which needs to be resolved.
Well, the other thing is that if it comes from a film noir, tension is very likely to be part of the language. Major minor chords, diminished chords, those types of sounds. Major minor being, you know, you can hear that in Vertigo and scores like that by Bernard Herrmann particularly. And I think also the other thing about the diminished chords is you can sometimes have, so this is the standard G diminished, but you can also extend these top notes to a tone up, and they're quite closely related, the major minor and the diminished, and they certainly do appear in lots of those black and white men in hats, dark key lit films. I mean, for me, when he's playing this, the chords are similar but not the same as we play normally, and I would say, for me, it feels quite like a Red Garland-y vibe. There's quite a lot of block chord going on. There's quite a lot of Red Garland-like. You know, Red Garland was a boxer, wasn't he, before he was a pianist?
Mm-hmm.
And he tends to play the piano quite pugilistically, I think. Very sort of solid. It's a very solid interpretation. But he does throw in a few little tricks, doesn't he? Like going into triplets or 3-4 feel at some points.
Yeah. Yeah, in the bridge, he kind of implies a 3-4 time signature, doesn't he, in the bridge?
It's something he does elsewhere in the album, I think. And after a solo, he goes straight to the bridge again, which is the middle part of the tune. It's what we call an A-A-B-A structure, so he goes in on the B. But The thing I noticed about the solo also is that he treats it quite like what I would call the Lester Young approach, where he's outlining the tune quite a bit in his solo. So you can hear the tune while he's, it's not very far away from the tune. He's not just taking the scale relationships and the chords and blowing over them as will become more his want later on in his life. Have you got any other observations that you would?
I mean, I think the only other thing is that it's interesting that he kind of plays it as a swing. I mean, it's quite slow, but it is definitely a swing feel. Whereas I think all the other versions, I mean, the Parker version is a ballad, and I think up until then it was kind of considered as a ballad. So whether he kind of initiated this idea of doing it as a swing, I mean, it tends to be done now more as a kind of medium swing, doesn't it? Again, following Miles Davis, really, who has kind of, well, it's kind of like a, it's a ballad which kind of goes into swing, really.
It's just kind of a slow swinger, isn't it?
Slow swing, yeah.
Rather than
yeah.
a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
The third track on the album is an original by Kenny Drew called Gloria. And it's a ballad, and it's an interesting chord progression. The tune is sort of in two halves, really. It's kind of like an A, B, A sort of form. The first part of the tune is in the key of A flat major, and then the B section is in the key of C major. So he's sort of looking at these two different sort of tonalities, really. And it includes a lot of these kind of chromatic 2-5. So 2-5-1 is a very common chord progression in jazz. It's like a cadence, really, in jazz. They tend to move around the cycle of fifths. So they tend to move up, down in fifths.
Yeah, why don't I demonstrate that?
Yeah. But here what he's doing is he's kind of shifting chromatically. So he's not going around the cycle of fifths. He introduces these kind of chromatic shifts where he's moving by a semitone, which creates this interesting effect and would be kind of explored a bit later. Musicians such as John Coltrane really, really looked at this. And when we look at Blue Train and the John Coltrane album, that we're going to talk about a bit later, he does a lot more of this on that album. So maybe I'll demonstrate a little bit of this kind of chromatic 2-5 movement in this tune.
Yes, it's one of the things I noticed about this tune that has what I call surprise key center 2-5-1s. The tune itself, well, it starts out and it does remind me a bit of Bill Evans, actually, a bit Waltz for Debbie again. Those sort of dee-da, dee-da, that sort of movement.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he gets into the actual tune, it's got some similarities for me with the tune It Never Entered My Mind. And the other thing I did spot, which we've already mentioned, is this sort of use of a waltz time on the outro. He plays the tune in 3-4, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
And in some respects, I found that the chord changes had a bit of a resemblance to Come Rain or Come Shine. I don't know if you felt that too.
Yeah. But they have a similar sort of this sort of chromatic descending sort of effect which he gets,
and we mentioned before that Blue Note liked their artists to write their own material, partly because they shared the publishing on it and sometimes actually had all the publishing on it, but also because that meant they didn't have to pay for the publishing of recording other people's tunes, basically. So you'll find there's quite a lot of a lot of the jazz records of this period, that was something that the producers preferred. And why you get contrafacts, I guess, as well, which is a set of changes with a new tune written on top that the improvisers are familiar with, let's say, playing the tune Laura, but then they stick a new melody on top, but they can still blow on those familiar chord changes that they do on gigs. So then we'll talk about a tune that you've done a transcription of, which is Be My Love.
Be My Love was a popular song written by Nicholas Brodsky and Sammy Kahn, 1950, and it was written for a film called The Toast of New Orleans. And it was in the film, it was sung by Catherine Grayson and Mario Lanza, who was a kind of a, I don't know how you describe him. He was a tenor, wasn't he? Quite a bit of a heartthrob sort of popular singer.
Yeah, I mean, he was, in a way, he was the classical Sinatra in some respects.
Yeah.
And equally had alleged mob connections. And it was the song was nominated for the best original song in the Oscars that in 1950.
Yeah, it was very popular. I mean, it was in the pop charts, I think, wasn't it?
Lanza had a big hit with it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it lost to Mona Lisa, which is interesting.
Oh, right, okay.
Another quite, in a way, similar sort of Italianate song from that period. Yeah, so, yeah, I think it was his first million selling record, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And what about the structure of the song?
Well, it's interesting that he takes it at a really fast tempo. Originally, it was a ballad. It was a kind of romantic ballad. I'm guessing, I mean, again, can't know this for sure, but I think this may well have been one of the first kind of jazz versions of this tune. I mean, it was written in 1950, you know, he's recording in 1953.
Mm.
I don't know of any early recordings. I know Kenny Dorham recorded it later that year, in December 53, but again, he plays it as a ballad, and most other versions I've heard, I mean, Keith Jarrett, more recently, he performed it as a ballad. But I've never really heard of a version where it's taken as a kind of fast bebop tempo like Drew does here.
Well, it seems to be a feature of what he does with this album's material. And I think on the original album cover, is it Leonard Feather or is it Ira Gittler? I can't remember who it is who does the liner notes. But they talk about him taking sort of what they call it a jump approach to some of the tunes.
Mm.
And I think it was Leonard Feather, and I think again, you know, he's saying, well, you know this tune like this, but I'm going to do it like this. So he's kind of making a
reinventing it sort
yeah,
of
or, statement or, yeah, yeah. On it,
yeah.
Which is quite a, you know, especially as it's introducing Kenny Drew album. I think he's saying, here I am. With these strong versions.
Yeah.
Also, they're all pretty much all very short. I think there's one 4-minute track on there. But they're all in the 2 to 3 minutes sort of jukebox length, easily consumable, and I would say quite popular in their idiom in terms of jazz at the time.
Mm. Yeah, so I transcribed his solo on this track, and I mean, it's very Bud Powell influenced. And, you know, we were talking about this a bit. I mean, I think that Kenny Drew is more of a kind of pure bebop player at this point in his career than, for example, Sonny Clark. And I think, I mean, you made the observation that it's harder to transcribe Kenny Drew because he tends to play, it's more angular. His placement is much more kind of off centre, if you like, I guess, for want of a better expression. Which in a way is more true to, I mean, the way I think of bebop, you know, is it's about kind of taking this language, these phrases, and really putting them in surprising places and this kind of discontinuity in a way. Whereas Sonny Clark was really all about continuity. It was this kind of really flowing sort of style. Whereas Drew, there is this kind of discontinuity in what he's doing, but it's deliberate. I mean, this is the style, isn't it? I think really.
Yeah, I think because he's got great technical facility, he can play. You know, when you take a lick through all 12 keys, there are some keys where you're kind of hoping you won't get there on a gig very often. You know, G flat minor or something weird. You know, there are keys that aren't, there aren't common in jazz tunes. There aren't that many tunes in A major, are there, or E major in jazz. It's nearly, it's often flat keys. But it seems to me that when you take a lick through certain keys, you get to a point where it's really quite hard to play that lick technically on the piano, because it just doesn't fit under the hands very well. And Kenny Drew doesn't seem to have that as an impediment. So he can play a lick where he wants to play it, if you like, because he's got a very good technique. And I found when I'm transcribing his stuff, it's like, well, how do you finger that? How would I?
It doesn't fall under the fingers.
It doesn't quite feel. And one of the things about taking down piano players as opposed to transcribing Charlie Parker is, you know, you get that. It's much more difficult to play saxophone licks on the piano.
So there's a couple of things I picked out of this solo, which just kind of go to illustrate what Kenny Drew's doing. So the first couple of examples are his use of the whole tone scale. The whole tone scale, do you want to demonstrate? Okay.
So when we talk about tones and semitones, that's a tone. That's a semitone. If you keep playing tones one after another, you get the "I entered a dream" sound. And it's used quite a lot in... It sort of turns up as a non-effect, because that sort of effect thing in films is used a lot, but as a non-effect in jazz, in a way, not to suggest a sort of dreamlike state. It starts appearing in the late 40s and early 50s, doesn't it?
Yeah, and here he's kind of using it over a dominant seventh chord, and which is one of the ways you can use this particular scale, and it sounds quite good. So this first example is he's playing this little three note pattern, which he kind of displaces and moves down, just moving down the scale. So let's have a listen to that. And in this example, he really just plays a series of thirds, again, just descending and down the whole tone scale. This next example is something which he uses quite a lot, and I think he probably gets it from Bud Powell. Bud Powell used to do this phrase quite a lot, where he's playing a little phrase in three four really, but he's using it in 4/4, so you end up with this weird sort of disjunct and kind of rhythmic displacement really, and so let's just have a listen to that. And the last example is his use of chromaticism. Again, Simon, maybe you just want to demonstrate this a little bit on the piano, what we mean by chromaticism.
Yeah, so when I earlier said about tones and semitones, a selection of semitones altogether is what we call a chromatic scale. And sometimes people will, in jazz, they'll particularly use extra notes that aren't in the scale. So if we're playing something in C major, they might, what we call, enclose something with extra notes that are a semitone away, which is often described as chromaticism.
Yeah, and this is a particular feature of bebop, really. And I think you can hear with Kenny Drew, particularly as he progresses, his playing becomes more chromatic. He really uses this idea of enclosure and chromaticism in his playing. So this is an example of a line using chromaticism.
Well, we're going to move on to talk about Lover Come Back to Me next. Lover Come Back to Me is another popular song composed by Sigmund Romberg and the lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein. And it was for a Broadway show called The New Moon, and it was introduced by Evelyn Herbert and Robert Halliday. The song was first published in 1928, so a lot of jazz standards come from the 20s and 30s. And there was a film adaptation of that stage show in 1930. And there was a Nelson Eddy did a version in 1940, which all of them were titled New Moon. And again, he uses a pretty fast tempo, doesn't he, on this?
Yes, it's sort of similar in a way. Although, having said that, I mean, the bebop players tended to play it quite fast. It became a sort of bebop staple, really, this tune, and they did tend to play it quite quick. I think probably Lester Young made this tune popular in the 1930s, and then it became part of the kind of bebop repertoire.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the tunes that Leonard Feather describes as having a jump treatment. And I think what he means is it's got a very rhythmic approach to it. And he uses a kind of riff, doesn't he, as an intro, as an outro, but also at the ends of each A section, he has this particular little pattern or riff.
Yeah, and he uses this interesting sound, which is like an E. It's an E major chord over an E flat note. I don't know if you can possibly just play that on just to. So it's quite a dissonant sound, but it was becoming quite popular. A lot of piano players were experimenting with these chords around this time. Again, not least Bud Powell, who used these sounds a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of triad, a semitone away. So a triad is three notes, and a semitone away means that the bass note is. You often get these that sound when a diminished chord is indicated, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a way of voicing a diminished chord, really. And he also does this interesting little kind of displaced rhythm. Again, he's using this rhythmic displacement quite a lot, where you're shifting the phrase out of where you kind of expect it to be, and it creates this kind of tension in the music, and he uses this a lot. This is a device he's using.
The other thing I noticed was that in his version, in his interpretation of the tune, he does go. There's a New Orleans thing called the Big Four, where you accent the fourth beat of the bar to give a kind of kick. It's almost like a syncopation that isn't a syncopation, and it works even more like a syncopation at this fast speed. And in the tune, he often will surprise you in a way by getting to the next bar on the fourth beat of the bar, won't he?
Yeah.
But as you say, his solo is exceptionally crisp and beboppy, lots of chromatic lines and fast lines. He seems to be one of those players who enjoys, you know, showing off the fireworks, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, he's just sort of he's got great technique, and he likes to kind of likes to show it off, really, I guess. But it's always really musical. I mean, you don't feel that he's just showing off his technique. It has a musical kind of substance to it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that can get a bit dull for people, is when you get real speed merchants who that is really all they've got to offer. And I think I would say that Kenny Drew is really just playing lines fast, as opposed to just playing fast, if that makes sense. Because it's quite easy to play things that sound impressive that aren't necessarily particularly wholesome musically, I suppose, is what you might say. So yeah, he's very good at that. So the sixth track on the album is Everything Happens to Me, and that's a pretty well-known ballad these days, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very popular ballad with jazz musicians. It was originally sung by Sinatra with the Tommy Dorsey Band. I think it was 1941 it was written. Matt Dennis and is it Tom Adair?
Yeah, 1940, I think.
Oh, 1940, okay. And it was actually, again, it was another kind of pop hit. It reached number 9 in the pop charts. And it was another one of these standards that Charlie Parker recorded in 49 with strings, which again kind of popularized it, I think, as a jazz tune.
I think also this, I mean, the Tommy Dorsey connection, Tom Adair and Matt Dennis were, they wrote a lot of good tunes for Tommy Dorsey, and in fact he sort of installed them in a hotel room almost as kind of musical slaves, churn out some big tunes for me. And Frank Sinatra, definitely, he in a way, his first stint with the Dorsey bands was his break, wasn't it? His big break. And he does he records it quite straight, doesn't he, Sinatra? And it, later, the ironic nature of the words come a bit more nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Mm.
But there are a lot of really good, I mean, Chet Baker does it as well, doesn't mm-hmm. he, on the album we're going to talk about in episode two.
Mm-hmm.
But, I did compare it with Bud Powell's recorded trio version, which actually has Curly Russell on it as well,
mm-hmm.
But it was with Max Roach on mm-hmm. drums in 47. In fact, Bud Powell never, it's a 2:40 version, and he never plays anything but the head, really.
No,
it's just an embellished version of the tune, if you like.
Mm.
Well, but Kenny Drew here, he plays it at what we would call, you know, it's not quite a ballad tempo, is it? It's a slow...
kind of walking ballad, I guess.
Yeah, a walking ballad or slow swing.
Mm-hmm.
And he shows off his blues inflections here, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's playing is much more imbued with the blues. I mean, we talked, again, comparing him a little bit with Sonny Clark. We talked about the fact that Sonny Clark probably used the blues language less, whereas Kenny Drew, he really, it's a really big part of his vocabulary. I think he draws a lot on the blues.
Yeah, and the other thing I noticed on this was that he was using florid lines in the kind of swing pianist way, but I suppose they're more bebop-oriented swing pianist type. I mean, it's more in the speed and the nature of the lines than the actual content of the line. So he doesn't use these sort of sixth chords that those sorts of that we get a lot in that you hear a lot Teddy Wilson play. Have you got any further things to say about this particular tune?
No, I'm happy to move on. The next track is It Might As Well Be Spring, which is a Rodgers and Hammerstein tune written in 1945 for the film State Fair. It was sung in the film by Gene Crane, and it's kind of interesting because the State Fair is in summer, and I think they particularly wanted to write a kind of a spring type song. Obviously it was going to be a problem because the film was set in summer, so that's why they came up with this idea of It Might As Well Be Spring, even though it isn't spring, which is kind of funny. And I think it was their only original film score, this film. And it's also kind of interesting that they originally wanted it to do it as a kind of up-tempo track, but the director wanted, at this point in the film, he wanted a more slower sort of tune, which is interesting because it's very often now played actually kind of more up-tempo, isn't it? Sometimes played up-tempo, this tune.
Yeah, it has people do interpret it as a fast tune.
Mm.
It's interesting because also it's the only tune that we found, in terms of research, it's the only tune where the song has a completely different alternative melody that was written from what ended up being the final version.
Mm.
And the first take was very legato musical line, but it's possible that Hammerstein's words sort of brought a more jumpy, leapy melody, to go with the words of things like puppets on a string and
restless as a
yes, those yeah. those sorts of things. And it's it's very interesting. You mentioned that it's their only film score. Obviously, people are going to think that's odd. I'm sure they wrote loads of films, but in fact, mostly they just wrote the songs for films.
Yes.
But this one, they actually did
score the whole
movie.
Yeah.
And that means all the bits of music that you're not supposed to notice, mm-hmm. as well as the bits of music you are supposed to notice. And one of the things I've often thought about is when you go to see a film, you also are hearing a film. But you don't get any choice in what you hear. It's an artistic decision to put the music that's there. But of course, there are many different options, and there are plenty of films. For example, a famous one is 2001, A Space Odyssey, where there was an entire score composed and it was thrown out. So you didn't get to hear that score, and this alternative version of the melody is quite intriguing to me.
Mm.
Another great example of that is the film Troy that came out a while back that had an entire score written, and then they brought in James Horner to rewrite, an entirely new score, because they weren't happy with the one they'd commissioned.
Mm.
Anyway, it's in terms of its treatment, it reminded me the first time I heard it, and I checked the dates, it's actually pre this, but it reminded me of the way that Andre Previn Trio treated tunes like, did shows like My Fair Lady, mm-hmm. and West Side Story.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, both of the pianists released in the same year, in 57, they both released trio albums of Pal Joey.
Right, yeah.
And Andre Previn stuck to the tunes literally from the show, but I think Kenny Drew chose other Rodgers and Hart tunes,
mm-hmm.
Because of the link here with Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's just that kind of way of jazzing up a popular something that's out there, and people might buy a jazz version of because they know the film version,
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Have you got thoughts on the way in which he interprets it?
Well, he kind of plays it as a fairly quick kind of swing, doesn't he? And he uses this kind of dominant pedal intro, which, again, it's quite a common device, which he uses quite a lot. And then the head, he's got these kind of hits in the head, which work quite nicely. So it's a nice little arrangement he's put together with this tune, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely... it carries on my idea that I think he was really trying to make a statement with this album, that it sounds like he's really thought about each of these arrangements.
Yeah, they haven't just kind of thrown them together, you know, they're proper arrangements.
Yeah, it's definitely not a jam session, what tune should we play next?
No.
Okay, let's do this one. They're really, and the band obviously know what's going to happen as well, so you get those da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. All those sorts of articulations in there. And of course, we've said this before on the previous podcast, that Blue Note did pay for rehearsals.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So quite often, the Blue Note album, I think it adds a lot to Blue Note's output that
Absolutely.
They did pay for
yeah.
those rehearsals. And people were turning up to the studio with a bit more planning than on some other
yeah.
labels, for example.
Yeah.
And of course, he rounds off the album with another original of his own. It wouldn't be an original by someone else, of course, which is Drew's Blues, and I think that this one probably is a bit more of a busker, isn't it? It doesn't seem to have any arranged nature to it.
In fact, he could well have written it in the session sort of thing. I don't know, but it's good. I mean, it's good. It's just a blues in F. And again, he's a really competent blues player. I mean, his blues playing is really... it's a real feature of his style, I think.
Well, I did start to transcribe this one, and I have to say, one of the reasons I chose it was, it's a blues in F, that should be pretty straightforward.
Mm.
But in fact, I did find it quite challenging to because blues figurations are they are statements, not they're like interjections almost, aren't they? Whereas with a bebop line, there's some sort of logic that you follow.
There's a flow, yes, yeah.
With the blues inflection things, they're little things.
Gestures.
Yeah, they're
kind
gestures.
Of, yeah, yeah.
It's a very... And his particular, again, you know, the way I play a blues is very different. None of his patterns fit my fingers very well, even on an F blues, which I found quite surprising. Well, great. We need to wrap up in a moment, and we will talk about perhaps what's coming next. So that's the end of our first episode of our second series. You can listen to our first series as well and recap on the Sonny Clark thing, which is on our Buzzsprout web page or through the usual podcast suppliers, whichever one you like to choose. We have a Facebook page for 251, which gives out information on things that are coming up, and we post up, as we've already said, extra information plus playlists and video teasers, those sorts of things. That's also available with much more material, including the transcriptions on our Patreon page. And we would really be grateful if people would be able to support us on that. As we've said earlier in this episode, we'd really like to be able to play the tracks to discuss them and be part of the show. But that does always cost cash because it's copyright material. So if we can get more subscribers to Patreon, then we'll be able to make the podcasts even better. You can follow us on Facebook individually, Nick Tomlin and Simon Whiteside. And I'm also on many of the other things like Twitter and Instagram. Nick, do you have anything to add?
No, I think you've covered it, Simon.
So our next episode is going to be on the Chet Baker album It Could Happen to You, Chet Baker Sings, of which Kenny Drew. I'm getting the wrong Clark. Kenny Drew is the pianist. So until that time, goodbye from me, Simon Whiteside.
It's goodbye from me, Nick Tomlin.